All right. Good morning. All right. We left off kind of at the top of page 3 of your notes. We're talking in the context here, we've been talking about interpreting Genesis as narrative in its historical context. When we use the word narrative, again, we're talking about another word we can use is story. I always use that word cautiously, though. I like the word story a lot because it communicates something more to us, but it's dangerous because people can think story and think made up, fairy tale, fiction, fantasy. But a story can be a true story, and a true story is shaped by its author to communicate certain ideas and values. And narrative does that. That's what narrative is. A good narrative doesn't just give you a list of brute facts. It actually shapes what happened to communicate something to the reader or readers. So they're arranged for a purpose. Now, we left off there on letter B with this key principle. We said a key principle in understanding narratives and their purposes is this: what did the narrative mean to the author's original audience? I think that's kind of where we left off last week. What did the narrative mean to the author's original audience? So if an interpreter is going to be able to answer that question as it relates to Genesis, that person needs to attempt to think about what was happening when Moses wrote Genesis. And that's kind of where we left off. So what's happening as Moses writes this book? Well, number one, first of all, note that the book of Genesis is written sometime between when the exodus of the people of Israel occurred and the death of Moses. It is almost assuredly towards the end of Moses' life and before the people of Israel crossed over the Jordan into the promised land. Now, the reason I say that sometime between Exodus and Moses' death is the Pentateuch would have taken a long time to write. So did he write it all during the wilderness wanderings? Did he write Genesis after, Israel, before they went to Mount Sinai? Somewhere along that way, Moses starts to write the Pentateuch. I suspect it's towards the end of the wilderness wanderings, but the Bible doesn't say with certainty. What we do know, though, it's before Moses dies that he composes Genesis, right? So it's before his death, and thus that means it's before the people of Israel have crossed over the Jordan. So let's just give ourselves just a simple chronology of events. Remember, in Joseph, that's great-grandson of Abraham, Joseph goes to Egypt. Eventually, all of the brothers and Jacob follow. There's a promise given that they would return back to the promised land one day. They know that is to be true. You pick up in Exodus, and you have the people of Israel under a new king, a new Pharaoh, who does not know Israel and does not know Israel's God. And they begin to persecute, the Egyptians persecute the Israelites. God miraculously preserves Moses' life, sets him apart for a purpose of leading the people of Israel out of Egypt. They go and they receive the law of God at Mount Sinai. Instead of the people listening and heeding the voice of the Lord, they demonstrate their stiff-neckedness, as King James, the New King James translates it, right? They were a stiff-necked people. They rebelled against the Lord. They did not have faith to enter in the promised land. They wander for 40 years, two generations of people are allowed to live, but everybody over the age of 20 dies off, and you have now Moses is at the end of his life, and he finishes up with the book of Deuteronomy. He's not allowed to go into the promised land, and you have these people who are now getting ready to go in the promised land. Okay, that's somewhere in there in that wilderness wandering part two. Before Moses dies, we have the construction of the book of Genesis. We should also note that the book of Moses, or I should say, I don't want to say book of Moses, that should be book of Genesis. The book of Genesis does not stand alone, It is part of the Pentateuch. It's part of the Pentateuch. Now remember, when we talk about that word Pentateuch, it literally means five books or five scrolls. five books or five scrolls. Those are the first five books of the Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. All five of these books are written by Moses, and all of them are related to each other. Now, another term that you will hear sometimes use to describe these first five books, you will hear sometimes people talk about the Torah. Torah can be used in multiple ways, but often it's used to describe those first five books. Also, I'll note this a little bit later, I don't know if we'll get to it today. Sometimes these first five books are called the books of Moses, right? And there's good reason for that. But Pentateuch is a term that is often used to describe these first five books. And they are related to each other. They are related to each other. And I just want to illustrate this for you. All right, so if you've got your Bibles, go to Genesis 50. Go to Genesis 50. So what we think of as Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, we're going to talk about that they do have individual themes, but they have strong interdependence and relationship to each other. So if you're in Genesis chapter 50, this is the text where Joseph is dying. He's not going to be long for this world. He offers blessings. But he also offers, even as I mentioned just a moment ago, he offers some promises. And a key one occurs in Genesis 50 and verse 24. There it says, "And Joseph said to his brethren, 'I am dying.'" Brethren, think whole clan, whole family here. "I'm dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land," Egypt, that's where they're at. "He'll bring you out of this land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So out of this land, to the land of which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now Joseph here, of course, it demonstrates his great faith in God's promises. God would deliver his people. He would take Israel back to the promised land. It would be theirs to possess, right? So that's how the book of Genesis ends, with this promise. Joseph died. Now, if you go ahead just a little bit in your Bible to Exodus, this is really a continuation of the story, of the narrative. Okay, so watch how this works. So, I mean, we've basically just closed with Joseph dying, Genesis 50, verse 26. And then Exodus 1 and verse 1. "Now, these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man in his household came with Jacob." And we have Jacob's 12 sons: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob, who were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And, just as we heard at the end of Genesis 50, "And Joseph died, all his brothers, and all that generation." Now, Moses is clearly connecting what happens at the end of Genesis 50 to the beginning of Exodus. The story is just continuing. Now, you might ask, why did Moses break this up into five books? And there are a couple of different theories on that. One is, I do think that each one of the books do have particular emphases. That's important to understand. We're gonna touch on some of those in Genesis. But the other, just practically, those five books as one big honkin' scroll really just wasn't going to work too well. All right, so you did need to divide things up. What Moses wants to make the reader clear on is that these things are connected. See? So it's true, as we say in your notes there, it's true that each book of the Pentateuch has its own central theme. But the interpreter needs to remember that Moses wrote them to be connected as well. And you can see that in that chart that I've produced for you there. They're a unified set of scrolls in many ways. There's a connection to each one of them. And that's going to become important as we study Genesis, to see how does Moses link what he says in Genesis later on in the Pentateuch. And there are important links. There's links in terms of story themes, and there's links even linguistically in the grammar of what he does. right? Moses is a great, great writer, as most of the Bible writers are. They're actually great authors, and they're very thoughtful. And they put in, they sprinkle in these things that if you think through this like this, you'll see the connections happen quite frequently. If we've time, we'll actually explore a few of them here today. All right? So there's a little bit of the understanding, key principle. What's going on? The original reader, how do they understand what was going on? What did the author intend to say to the original reader? And Moses is writing, he's about to die. The people of Israel about to cross over into the promised land, and he writes Genesis and connects that book to these other five total, the Pentateuch, these five scrolls. Now, let's think a little bit more about the historical context. Remember when we said that we're teaching through Genesis, I'm trying to give you the tools to be able to interpret the Bible for yourself. So let's understand the historical context. When Moses, we've already noted this, but let's make this clear in our mind. When Moses wrote the Pentateuch, the people of Israel have already left Egypt. As I mentioned, they are likely at the end of their 40-year wandering through the wilderness. And we should note that the original readers, assuming that the Pentateuch was written at the end of Moses' life, was written to people who were one or two generations removed from the miracles of the Exodus. So let's just remember, okay? So we said earlier, remember that God tells the people of Israel to go conquer Canaan, right? And they're to go conquer Canaan, and they didn't have faith to do so. And God's judgment was, if my memory serves me, everybody over the age of 20 is going to die off, right? Okay? And then they spend the next 40 years in the wilderness. And during those 40 years, there's a lot of people born. Now, let's think about the people who were of that generation who were not above 20. So they're 20 and under, okay? How many of them would really remember the Exodus well? Well, of that generation, a significant amount. I mean, if you're 20 and you walk through the Red Sea, it's going to stick in your mind. It's kind of like, I remember where I was when 9/11 happened. Okay? So, like, that's just going to stick in your mind really, really well. If you're 10, do you remember it? You remember it. But you're also at 10 probably going to misinterpret some details. For instance, talk to somebody who was 9 or 10 years old about 9/11. Or put it this way, my mom describes the day in which JFK was shot. She was a very little girl. Here's what she remembers about that day. She remembers that the teacher talked about this, and they brought in a television in class. Can anybody remember that? Anybody? Okay. A few of you remember that? Now, yes, you were. All right.
The teacher cried.
Oh, the teacher cried. Okay. Now, when you were a little person, you understood the severity of that event, but you probably didn't understand the full ramifications of that. Now, you might now, and the reason you do that is because people later on have told you about that event. In fact, in some ways, I'm not accusing anybody, but we actually tend to reconstruct past events with knowledge that's been given to us later. We reinterpret what happened in the past. You probably actually think you knew more about that day than you actually did. But if you actually go back and remember, what did I actually know? And the same thing, if you take somebody who's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 on the day of 9/11, they're going to remember everybody's serious. They might have some images seared in their mind about the Twin Towers falling. Very different than me, who was 20 years old when that happened. Actually, yeah, 19, almost 20, somewhere in there, all right? When that happened, that's really seared in my mind. And there's a whole bunch of things. I was reading newspaper articles, all that stuff when that was happening. It's so we have one generation that's like that. It's okay. So some of them are like, yeah, I remember the Exodus really well. But then you got the next generation. So they've been in the wilderness 40 years. You've got two more generations of people that have been walking around the wilderness for 40 years. They've been born. they have never seen Egypt. In fact, what is the totality of their experience up to this point? Not exactly a pleasant thing, right? They have lived every day of their life with manna and quail. God has provided, but that's all they know. The most that they've heard is stories of people who were at their oldest 20 years old who had been in Egypt. By the time you get to all those little ones, two generations down, maybe their grandparents talked about some things, great-grandparents if they met them, but they're stories. They're not actual experiences for them. And that means that they're going to have a number of questions. So we see this there in number two. Moses is about to die. He's the only constant, other than we would say Jacob or Joshua and Caleb. Moses is about to die. The leader who led them and their parents and their grandparents out of the land of Egypt, he's now going to pass away. What kind of questions might they have? The people are entering the land of promise. They have not seen the plagues of Egypt. Most of them had not seen the parting of the Red Sea. They had not seen wicked Pharaoh being swallowed up by the Red Sea. They would have serious questions, such as, where did we come from? Why do we have the right to have the land? And how do we know that God will be with us? Now, you got to put yourself in their shoes. Moses tells them, about to die. Here's five books. These are going to be important to you. All right. These are answering significant questions for their hearts, their minds, practically, logically, in their affections, how they feel about all of this. So in Genesis, we learn where the people of Israel came from. It tells the story about who they are as a people. Where did we come from? And you learn God called their forefather Abraham from among the nations to create a special people for himself. We learn Abraham had a son, Isaac, who then had a son, Jacob, who was later named Israel. He had 12 sons. Those 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. They moved to Egypt where they had lived for hundreds of years. And here they are. Gives the account. How did they get to Egypt? How did they leave Egypt? Why are they in the wilderness? And where is this all headed? That answers important questions. Where the people of Israel came from. It also answers questions like, why the people of Israel had the right to the land of Canaan. Now, I've got some things listed here. But even very early on in Genesis, what's the first introduction we have to Canaan as a concept? Where do we first meet?
Noah, wasn't it?
With Noah, yes.
One of his sons had a son named Cain.
All right, so Noah's grandson had a son named Canaan. All right. What happens to Canaan? What does Noah do to Canaan? He curses him. So Moses is doing that on purpose. I think that's true. That did happen. To make a connection that the people, the descendants of Canaan, are cursed. That's important to them. They're about to enter into the land of promise. Why do we get to take the land from them? They're cursed. There's a whole bunch of other things that they've done and they're not good. God was ready to destroy them. All right. But even more than that, you see there under in your notes there, we learn why the people of Israel had the right to the land of Canaan. They had the right to the land because God in his grace promised the land of Israel first to Abraham, then to his son Isaac, then to Jacob, then to his 12 sons. And as we noted earlier, God makes this very clear in Genesis 50 and verse 24 through Joseph. God will surely visit you, and he's going to bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now think about that. You've got four generations that have received this promise. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, all of them declare, God declares through them, that they would possess the land. So when the first readers received the book of Genesis, they could know that they had the right to enter the promised land because the God of heaven promised to give them the land. Okay? So they learn where we came from. They learn why they had the right to the land of Canaan. And by the way, that's not insignificant, okay? We still wrestle with these concepts today, even as a nation. Okay? All right? Here's a term for those of you who remember a little bit in your history. Manifest destiny. You know that concept? All right? U.S. had this concept. We're going to take the whole swath of land. You ever really study that concept? Have you gone through it? I don't know about you, but there's parts of that that makes me kind of uneasy. Is that fair to say? Like, it's just obvious that it's our destiny to possess this whole land. Maybe not to the people who are already there. Trust me, I'm not trying to go all woke and try to refight these past wars. That's done and passed in my mind. But here we are, hundreds of years later, and we're still actually wrestling through that concept, even as a nation. Did we have these rights? So here the people of Israel are wondering, do we have the right to take this land? And they were going to take it. They're going to take it by force. And Genesis helps to answer that question. Yes, you do. Yes, you do have the right. God promised it. These people are cursed. You also read through the Pentateuch and into Joshua and Judges, and you find out that the people of Canaan were horrifically wicked and needed judgment. We also learn, number three, how they could know that God would be with the people of Israel. So, hear this very carefully. If you look all throughout the book of Genesis, God is the real hero of the narrative. God is the real hero of the narrative. It is God who creates. It is God who promises. It's God who plans. It's God who judges. It's God who redeems. It's God who elects or chooses. All right? If you read Genesis and you come away thinking about how great Abraham was, or Jacob was, or Joseph was, I'm going to suggest that you have read Genesis wrongly. God is the hero of the whole story all the way through. So we can ask ourselves an important question. Do the main characters in the book of Genesis look like good examples all the time? All right, I've got a list there of people, and I'm going to hand out some more notes. I wasn't sure if we were going to get to these today. Actually, can I get a volunteer to help me do some of this? Thank you. But I can do some of this while we're talking. All right, we're going to start out with Adam and Eve. Let's just state the obvious for each one of these. How do they come out? How do they come out in this book? You want one as well? All right. What's the problem with Adam and Eve? Let's just say it. Let's say the easy things here. Yeah, they ate the fruit really clearly. Right? And then who do I have next on that list? Cain. What do we got going on with him?
Murderer.
Who do I got next on that list? Lamech. Remember him? Genesis 4. He's a descendant of Cain. What goes on with him?
A murderer too.
I heard it. He's a murderer too. Yes. What else?
He had two wives.
Remember that? He's the first polygamist. Nice fellow. Has everybody got one of these? Thank you, Scott. In fact, remember Genesis in Genesis 4. He says, I'm going to paraphrase here, you know, he brags about the fact that I've killed a young man for wounding me, right? So he got some sort of wound. He, in revenge, kills him and then brings up his great-great-great-whatever grandfather, Cain, and says, you know, I've God's going to avenge Cain sevenfold, he's going to avenge me 70-fold. 70? Is it 77? I can't remember anymore. I have to look. I mean, this guy is bragging and literally shaking his fist in the face of God. You got Noah. All right, we like to think of Noah as a great hero. Is he? Yeah, some of you are, kind of, yeah.
Sometimes.
What's the last thing that we see of Noah?
Drinking.
Quite so hero-ish.
Yeah, he's drunk, and he experiences this some sort of sexual perversion with one of his sons. It's unclear what that is. Okay. And then a curse is issued on Canaan. Not exactly great, right? Then we've got the Tower of Babel. What's the problem? What's the fundamental problem of the Tower of Babel?
Rebellion against God.
Got rebellion against God, and it manifests itself. It manifests itself in that rebellion, they gathered into one place when God had said, spread out all over the land. Okay? They don't come out looking good. How about Abraham? What's that?
I think then they also thought that they could make their own way to God, like the tower.
Yes, good. They thought they could make their own way to God. All right? Then you've got Abraham. Now, there's a lot good about Abraham. A lot good. There's a reason why the New Testament talks about him as the father of faith. But if you read through the Abraham narratives, Genesis 12 through 25, I would argue you see almost as many failures as you do successes. What were some of his failures?
Lying.
How many times did he do that?
Twice.
Yeah. What else?
Married Hagar.
Yeah. Took Hagar. Well, he didn't even marry her. Yeah. I mean, that's a problem, too. But I know what you're saying. Yeah. He didn't marry her. Took her as a concubine. And the fundamental problem with that is he doubted the promises of God. Yeah. Those are not pretty pictures. Okay, so Abraham, he does many great things. Isaac, how many good things can you find about Isaac?
He loved Rebecca.
Okay, he loved Rebecca. He did that, yes. We might also argue that on Mount Moriah, when God instructs Abraham to sacrifice his son, that we don't see any sense of Isaac fighting that. You know, we're kind of reading between the lines there, but it seems to be the case that he laid himself down willingly for that, trusted. So there's good things about him. But there are actually significant problems with Isaac. Like, one, he followed in his father's footsteps and lied about his wife. All right, that's a big problem. And then a second problem is that even though God had revealed through Rebekah that the older shall serve the younger, was Isaac willing to follow what God had said at the end of his life? Yeah, he had favoritism. He loved Esau more than Jacob and loved him to the point that he was going to go against God's intended plans. That's what we see of him. Jacob, a lot of great things, right? But
he's a deceiver.
Yeah, he's known as a deceiver. He's known as the supplanter. That's his nickname. I mean, what a way to be known. You have a lot of questionable things that happen with him and with his 12 sons. He takes two wives and two concubines. There's just a lot of ugly things that happen in Jacob's life. We'll eventually touch on some of those. In fact, this morning, we're going to touch on a few of those in our morning message. We're going to be in Genesis 50 here today, or 49 here today, and thinking about some of Jacob's sons. Jacob does not come out smelling well. I mean, even the whole thing, like when he goes back to the promised land and he decides that it would be a good idea to set out his least important people, the furthest in front of him, you know, his concubines and their kids first, and then his less favorite wife, and then his most favorite wife. I mean, that whole thing is just kind of like, ew, right? You know, like, I mean, if they kill them off, that's fine, and I'll go last. You know, that's not a good look. You know, way to be a man, Jacob, right? So he's got problems. All right, now this is probably the most controversial. How about Joseph?
I think he was a coward when he was growing up.
Why do you say that? I agree with you.
Well, he kind of bragged to his brothers about what God had told him about. He was going to, they were going to bow down to him. And his father favored him, and I think he was proud of that.
Yeah, it seems to me that's the case. The whole thing descends into problematic relations with his brothers, stemming from those actions to go tell those dreams to his brothers. Now, I know some people will debate that, but even Joseph, he's more good that you see of him than other characters, but it's not, I don't think it's squeaky clean. In addition, by the way, the whole narrative is actually emphasis on not just Joseph, but on the whole of the 12 brothers. The 12 brothers as a unit do not come out looking well, right? That's the forefathers of all the people who are getting ready to cross in the promised land. So it becomes very clear all the way through Genesis that God is the one who rescues sinful people and chooses to use them and redeem them. And that's what we mean by God's the hero of the story of Genesis. Now, that is not to say that we can't ever highlight and note praiseworthy elements of Eve, for instance, when I think she actually demonstrates faith after her son Cain was murdered and she acquires another man from the Lord. I think she actually demonstrates that she believed in the promise of the seed that would come from her that would rescue humanity. There's evidence of that. No doubt that Abraham has praiseworthy elements. I mean, Noah, crazy. I mean, build an ark for however long it took 70, 80, 100 years. Debate on how long that took, somewhere in that time period. That's insane, insane amount of faith. So those are good things to praise. But at the end of the day, if our hope is in those people, we have misread Genesis. The hope is in God. What does God do continually throughout that book in taking terrible situations and making good out of them? We're actually going to talk about that in our morning message time. Therefore, this is helpful. This is helpful for the people of Israel. Put yourself in their shoes. When the people of Israel received the Pentateuch, letter D, they could see God's gracious hand all the way through their forefathers. It is God's gracious act in choosing Israel that is a central theme throughout the book. I don't know why it says of Genesis. It should be of Genesis. That's a central theme. Because if you look at their forefathers, there isn't a good reason for God to use them. So it's all about God. So when you interpret this book, you should always be looking for that theme. What does it show us about God and his grace? What does it show about how people respond to God's grace? This is actually one of the things I think there are people, Christians sometimes, they really misunderstand much of the Old Testament, and Genesis is a perfect example. People will talk about, well, the Old Testament is just law, and the New Testament is grace. That is a fundamentally bad way of reading the Bible. Now, I understand what we mean by saying, in some sense, grace has come in its fullness in the person of Jesus. As Christians, we'd affirm that. But actually, I think if you read the Old Testament rightly, and specifically the book of Genesis, you see the fingertips of God's mercy and grace all over it. It's everywhere. And that actually, by the way, makes great application for us today. We see this gracious act of God developed in the genealogy that's brought forth throughout the book of Genesis. When you see the genealogy, especially after the flood, each person represents future vast swaths of people. Clearly, God chose Israel out of the nations, and I put that chart there for you. All along the way, there is a central core of Adam to Seth to Noah to Shem to Terah, that's Abraham's father, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 tribes. Along the way, there are people that we would often think should be the ones who would carry forth the line of God's promises, and they're not the ones. For instance, Seth is the third born of Adam. You look at Abraham. His son Ishmael is not chosen, but Isaac. Ishmael, even though he is the firstborn. Jacob, not the firstborn. Esau was. And even among the 12 tribes, we're going to highlight here this morning, the one who is promised to have the king come from them is not the first or the second or the third, but the fourthborn, Judah. And all of this is demonstrating God's unusual ways of bringing about his promises, and thus is an aspect of God's grace.
How about Adam and the second Adam? There's a parallel.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. The New Testament brings that up, yeah. But we'll get to that when we think about reading Genesis in light of the whole Bible, specifically as a Christian. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I don't know if we'll get to it next week or not. I think we need to stop right here. Okay. Questions? Yes?
Moses spends 40 days on the mountain. And then he's affected by God while he's there, physically, you know, because he comes down when he comes down. One of the times, it seems like he was there more than once. When he comes down, he is glowing, so we know he has a physical, shows forth a physical adjustment to his person because of being with God. So he's there for quite a while, probably way more time than. So I believe he received quite a bit of education. I kind of wonder, and this is a speculation on my part, that the five books of the law are given to him while he's up there, and a large portion of that is the prologue to why the law is so important. It gives the context, the proper context, come from God Almighty at that particular time. It's possible that there was more than just the Ten Commandments that was conveyed to him. You would think there would be, just considering the time that he was there.
Yeah, we know Moses is rightly identified as a prophet. All right, so whether he received it there or elsewhere or not, that's actually a common thing many people would hold to, that he received much revelation on the mountain during that time. There's also probably also important to note, too, that probably much of what Moses wrote was very common in terms of oral history throughout the peoples of the earth. So it may be a little bit of both and. Yep. All right. Next week, we'll come back together and think about interpreting Genesis in light of the Pentateuch. Again, we're doing all this to help give us some tools to help us understand.